well, with a number of caveats. I should note that I'm really focusing here on disk use of raw data, because that's one thing that people can sort of fairly straightforwardly extrapolate. So of course, it's hard to make projections, especially about the future. So, and I'll come back to this at the end, but here's a summary from CHEP 1991 of Computing at LEP, where a data accumulation rate of 2 gigabytes a day is considered substantial, and an analysis data set of dozens of gigabytes is considered fairly large. Whereas, today I could just take my laptop hard drive and, run for most of a year and take this data. So there's a key point here that the future, like FCCAJ, assuming you do a prior FCCE program, is further away from today than we are from 1991. So the capabilities that we will have at that point are a little tricky to figure out based on what we have today. We can figure out maybe needs, but how easy those are to satisfy is a little more tricky. So what's going to set resource requirements for raw data? This is going to be set by the detector readout channels, the luminosity of the accelerator, how the trigger system works, whether there is a trigger at all, whether quite a few proposals are effectively triggerless or are going to try and keep as loose a trigger as possible, and what sort of compression scheme you use in your readout and so on. So the more, the more sort of looking towards the far future a detector is, the more speculative all these numbers become. So for example, there's actually very, very well developed projections from ILC. And I think it's fair to say that probably FCCHH of the people I talk to are the most speculative on what they'll need. So as I said, it's kind of all these things, the disk requirements for raw data are fairly hard. The CPU needs are closely tied to specific choices made by the collaboration. So for example, the specific menu chosen for Jayant 4 processes affects your simulation time a lot. Cutoffs for where you stop tracking, very soft neutrons, things like that can affect things a lot. So this sort of stuff is really depends on, CPU needs really depend on the particular choices made and can be scaled, by orders of magnitude, depending on exactly your willingness to take a little bit of physics loss. And the LHC experience suggests that analysis formats might wind up being a very important part of resource needs. So I am really talking about raw data. But if you look at the even aggressive Atlas HLHC projections, you get analysis formats, including the simulation analysis formats, of a size comparable to the raw formats. So of course, raw data are kind of the mined gold of the experiment, and everything else can be rerun. It's much more difficult to rerun the accelerator. So this is kind of the thing that you really want to preserve. So I was asked to talk a bit about Monte Carlo, but for this reason, it's actually quite tricky because that depends a lot on the experiment computing model and the final analysis format. So I'll hint a little bit at sort of the range of number of events that experiments will tend to want compared to how many data events they record, but exactly how they store that is really up to the experiment in the end. So a little bit for on storage technologies for my colleagues in Energy Frontier who may not. for hard drive. And you can see that actually the hard drives are beginning to flatten out a little bit in their progress. And this is something of a concern that the current technologies are saturating and they need to move to more expensive more technologically tricky products to keep growing on the density side here. But as of today, there's actually quite a lot of headroom here for improving the density for tape to something similar to hard drives. And an interesting number, the actual, you know, in 2019, the total amount of, you know, this sort of very high storage capacity tape that was shipped was 114 exabytes, which when you'll see some of the projections for, you know, if we actually ran, you know, took some really aggressive FCCHH projections, that could easily suck up that entire amount of tape. Hard drives are the traditional random access technology, for those about 1,000 exabytes were shipped in 2020, and then solid state are true random access. Even with hard drives, you actually still have to seek. It's just a very fast seek in a physical way. These are most expensive per terabyte currently, but might converge with hard drives at some point, and that's sort of about shipped capacity, about a fifth of hard drives, but are catching up. So some characteristics of accelerator programs for the future. So lepton colliders and hadron colliders actually have quite somewhat distinct computational modes. So with lepton colliders, you're generally dealing with, you're looking for electric processes. These have relatively small and generally pretty democratic cross sections, you know, up to a few orders of magnitude, modulo some T-channel and diphoton processes, which you may have to deal with in triggers, for example, BAPA scattering. In some cases. So these tend to have very loose triggers in general. And in fact, in some cases are triggerless. The order of magnitude of events you're looking for, of Monte Carlo events to generate, you know, since basically you would like to get a good sample of all of these sort of interesting physics processes, then they're all sort of the same order. You wind up with about an order of magnitude 10 to 20 times more than what you had recorded in data for those processes. And operation on Z peak, which is, you know, orders of magnitude cross section above sort of the slow 1/s fall off of this cross section curve, presents unique challenges. You have very, very potentially very high event rates there for the giga or tera Z options. For hadron colliders, you're dealing with a very broad range of process cross sections. So here's an Atlas swap going from the proton and elastic cross section down to dye boson production spanning, you know, over 10 orders of magnitude. The triggers tend to be very tight, and the simulations are biased towards rarer processes here. You're not generating a whole bunch of inelastic production. And so the total Monte Carlo events, for example, for Atlas in run two, is sort of order 2.5 times data. So in fact, you wind up with fewer Monte Carlo events relative to the total collected data at hadron colliders. So if you're trying to evaluate what your rates are going to look like, so the raw data sizes per event do depend on the data acquisition model of the experiment. Not every channel is written out. Smarter hardware can do compression and reduction of data before it's recorded. So for example, there's a factor of 15 that was seen for one of the FCCEE proposals in the tracker data that obviously is very useful. But then there's this flip side that if you have unknown new physics that you aren't already designing your detector towards, you want to be open to new possibilities with strange detector signatures, you might want to keep as raw data as you possibly can. Then, of course, the trigger model comes in. The number of formatted and formative events depends on that. So, for example, LHCb is really pioneered, at least being very aggressive. This is essentially the trade-off of a simulation and of the CPU of it with storage. So already for Atlas and CMS, the sort of intermediate formats here are thrown out, and you start from a very early point in the chain if you want to do that. And the faster your simulation is, the value of the sort of raw Monte Carlo decreases even more. And then the number of interaction points in the design obviously affects that, and the numbers I show are for one interaction point of any given accelerator. So here's a baseline, here's Atlas for HLHC. So we forecast an increase of 3 about in the event size compared to run 2, and 8 times an event rate for mu of 200, so this HLHC point. With a sort of similar Monte Carlo to data ratio, I guess sort of order 2 or 2.5. And the main storage format for Monte Carlo is the analysis format, or even more processed and smaller formats than that. So in fact, the Monte Carlo doesn't exceed the raw data, although it does significantly exceed the data analysis format. And then once you combine Atlas and CMS and then LHCb and Elise, the total complex needs are rather more than this. But anyway, you can sort of get a sense of what we're talking about here with these event sizes and event rate of 10 kilohertz and a bit under a snow mass here running per year, you get about 600 petabytes per year. So we're getting into the approaching exabyte range. Again, this includes a replication factor. Oops, not that, page tone. Okay, for Circular E plus E minus machines, so there's estimates from CPC and FCCEE. So here we have very, very different rates for Z factory operation and high energy. So in fact, basically high energy is a small perturbation on what you would get for Z factory operation. If you're sized for Z factory, you have no problems handling high energy. There's actually a mention in the FCC CDR about the valueless of triggerless readout for Zs in terms of reducing the systematics induced by the trigger. If you're going for extremely precise measurements, you would like to be as open as possible in your acceptance. And at that point, maybe potentially having a trigger that you can't rerun, you've lost those events forever, might induce systematics that are hard to control. So there is some value in being able to read out the entire Z cross-section rate. And then there's also a very large cross-section for BABA scattering events, and those are needed for luminosity measurements. But in general, that's foreseen to be measured with special luminometer detectors and sent to, recorded in different event streams. So I don't include that here. And so here's scenarios, for example, for FCCEE at the Z-pole and CEPC at 240 GeV, its high energy Higgs running point. The event sizes differ primarily from this point here that I mentioned this optimization that's been done in the readout using FPGAs. Which does essentially a factor of 15 reduction in the tracker size. And that's, for example, basically you can imagine this could be significantly optimized. You see the very large difference in rates, event rates between sort of 100 kilohertz on Z-pole here, high luminosity to be fair, and 2 hertz at the very highest energies. And considering the running times, you wind up with sort of 2 exabytes per year on Z-pole and then a couple of hundred petabytes for high energy. So this is comparatively very small. And one thing that did occur to me is this sort of question whether this sort of rule of thumb 10 times statistics for Monte Carlo in E plus E minus machine, if that's really enough for precision Z physics, because you will presumably want to do a number of systematic variations. And the question is, well, can you actually constrain them at the level you need with only 10 times? So it could, this could potentially be some kind of an issue for certainly the simulation needs of the experiment. Going to linear E plus E minus colliders. So these have comparatively very low rates and low backgrounds. So in fact, both ILC and CLIC designs just record entire bunch trains and then pull out interesting events for them later. They're essentially triggerless. And so they're quite detailed projections from ILD about Monte Carlo and additional formats. So here's some projections here. So for example, recording one train in ILD would be 178 megabytes at 500 GB here with a rep rate of 5 hertz, giving you about 14 petabytes a year. For click, you've got shorter trains. It turns out that the event size, well, the train size recorded is a bit smaller, higher rep rate, and that gives you about an order of magnitude more data per year. The interesting events are quite a small fraction of the bunch crossings. And so even though you're maybe doing 10 times statistics for interesting events, the amount of simulation winds up being a very small compared to data. And then the non-raw data sort of, putting all the other formats together sort of doubles the amount of data compared to just the raw. For muon collider, we're getting a little bit more speculative here. So in fact, there's actually a real challenge simulating and knowing exactly what to do in the data taking side with the backgrounds from the decays of B muons. This is predicted to be something like 10 to the 8 particles per event. In fact, if you try and do the simulations of these, at the moment it's sort of full simulations order 1 day per event to run this. And so this really is a major challenge for simulation and tracking, but it's being worked on. So in fact, lots of constraints on the detector design come from being able to suppress these backgrounds with timing, granularity, and also having to make sure that everything is radiation hard against that. So the data rates are very speculative. Some early estimates would say sort of order 50 megabytes per event with about order kilohertz to tape. So estimating say 2 kilohertz at the outside, we get about 2 exabytes a year, which is not actually in the end that large. But in some sense, this event rate, this trigger rate is being tuned to make this not get too high. So you could easily imagine more like order 10 or 100 rates. Kilohertz rates if you were to open up the triggers. Now going to Hadron Collider, FCC 8H numbers are extremely speculative here. So we've got a very, very different scale of challenge in the data.
Hello, for those who are still connected to the main Zoom room, all the parallel sessions are in breakout rooms. So if you want to listen to one parallel session, join a breakout room as shown in the slide that is shared. Thank you.
Easier to meet as we get there. Otherwise, requirements are not wildly beyond those for HLHC. So with the exceptions of E plus E minus Z pole and muon collider are a bit beyond, but still within factor of a couple. One thing that comes up is these things again are in the future. There's the opportunity potentially to be more aggressive on this if this is limiting physics. So for example, people may be sort of implicitly or explicitly trying to design to LHC limits on capacities when this is not, when they should allow for things to get better in the future. But there's also cases where it's a sort of a natural limit from the accelerator or the detector optimization or the data acquisition. So for example, the linear collider experiments, I think, are fairly don't have very much to gain from increasing headroom there. And then of course, similar situation for CPU. As I say, one might expect in some cases a similar situation for CPU requirements that we're not so far beyond the HLHC. Again, the muon collider has its own particular issues, but this really depends on the optimizations of physics trade-offs and future algorithm developments. So that's all I have.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Can you stay for a couple of questions?
I can stay for one or two questions.
Okay, so let's see if I see hands raised. I don't see any hands raised. So let me ask you a question. So first of all, thank you very much for this very nice presentation. You even have some numbers in here, which is quite impressive. And I like your conclusion that it looks like the far future does not pose, I'm gonna try to be careful about how to say this, the kind of challenges that would involve very large factors more in computing resources, in the sense that you are suggesting that we could be more aggressive in what relates to the design of the detectors, the physics capabilities, etc. Is that the message you want to pass?
I think it's fair to say that for everything except FCCHH, and I think they know well that they have challenges even before the data get written out, right? And in fact, there is a sort of relationship between the capacity of being able to of your trigger farm and what you can write out. So it's actually not decoupled from each other. So in fact, there is a connection between the data acquisition and these problems. So with that exception, I would say, yeah, it's almost certainly the case that no one is going to be constrained, at least technologically, by the capability to write out large amounts of data or to store them. They're not so far beyond what we already anticipate that we can do. So if that is a thing that limits physics capability, then people can rethink that.
We have a question from Gordon.
Peter, that was a great talk. I wanted to call specifically, I've got an echo from somebody.
It's me.
Oh, sorry, Peter. So one of the things that you drew attention to earlier in the talk was the relationship between looking for new physics and how much data you saved. And I think you, at another point, made a point. It's like, are people designing to the HLLHC data rates because that's what they know, versus who knows what will be possible on the timescales of these new accelerators? And I this is a comment. I just wanted to make sure people appreciated that, because you could imagine that there's some weak coupling that requires very high scale interactions, but is actually soft when it shows up in the data, which would require us to actually write out huge amounts of data in order to see it. And thinking a little bit about the trade-off between physics and data, I think is extremely important when we think towards the future. And your other comment at some point, Peter, you made this comment about not really knowing in 20 years exactly what storage or bandwidth possibilities, what will serial links look like, et cetera, I think is also quite apropos. And we shouldn't necessarily be constrained by today's technology for some of these machines, which would be 20 some odd years in the future. But yeah, excellent talk. Thank you.
I actually just comment on that. Like, there are at least two cases that I reviewed when putting this together where it was very clear that essentially, like, they had written down, we choose this in order to not, to not wildly exceed HLHC, capabilities. So in some cases it's a little bit closer future accelerator. In some cases it's far out. But in fact, I informally know that this is happening, that people are designing to a specific ceiling when they probably could be more
problematic. It makes sense, but yeah, it's something we should at least be very aware of.
Okay, I do need to go, but thanks.
Okay, thank you, Peter. There is a question or a comment from Zach. Maybe he can make it anyway, even if you need to leave.
Peter's gone. So I'll ask it, and maybe if someone else knows, they can answer it. I'm curious whether these folks have, these folks being the various detector and accelerator groups, have said anything about where they're going to do their compute. So I think Peter spoke a lot about the data required, and to some extent we can scale for the CPU required, but I'm wondering about the network and how much we're going to be moving all the data around, since that could be a limited resource in the future as well.
Indeed.
I just add that I thought that was I think, Zach, that's an excellent point. You know, the way Peter approached this is, what is the size of the raw data, with the implication that everything follows from that, including networking, you know, your analysis data set size, how you're going to do analysis, things like that will all scale relative to how much raw data is written.
I guess the point is, if we have a model like we have for the LHC now, where it's a highly distributed model, that's very different from some of the models where we put everything on one single farm. For some of the sizes for like the electron-positron colliders, you can put everything on one farm and do everything in one place. You don't have to distribute the data around the world. Your network requirement could be zero. I don't know if that's the sort of thing is possible for the HH kind of data sizes. But yeah, just wondering if people thought of that.
Okay, I think we should move to the next presentation, and that's me. So let me share it. Can you see it?
Yes, we do.
I okay. really like that picture.
Yes, because I am a man of faith, and I believe that we will be visiting you, Gordon, next
year. And we will all be together in Seattle.
That's right, and we will have a very large conference dinner all together, right? Okay. I will give you a brief introduction to how the computational frontier is self-organizing. I'm also going to tell you what is that we are doing. And we are also going to share with you some questions. What I should say, in some cases, these are talking points to initiate the conversation between the two frontiers. If you take a look at the SNOMAS webpage and you follow the link to the computational frontier, you will see a lot of information. But in a few words, I would like to tell you what the computational frontier is doing. CompEF will assess the software and computing needs of the high energy physics community, emphasizing common needs and common solutions across frontiers. We want to gain an overall understanding of the community needs and discuss common solutions to these needs. In the context of the potential solutions that we are discussing within the energy physics community, but also within other science disciplines and industry. And I would like to make a couple of important points. The first is that Computing for High Energy Physics is not an independent research program. It serves the high energy physics program by building computing infrastructure and developing software in support of the physics programs. And in doing so, it adapts and applies cutting edge technology to the specific needs of high energy physics. And it also conducts R&D to address challenging programs. And it actually goes without saying that it requires teams of highly skilled individuals who possess a diversity of experience and expertise. And something that has become apparent during the last few years is that Computing for HUP these days requires a level of effort that is as complex and resource intensive as that that we spend in detectors. We have three conveners in the computational frontier. Steve Gottlieb is a theoretical particle physicist. Oliver Gusche and Ben Nachman are experimentalists. I am Daniel Elvira. I'm also an experimentalist, and I am the liaison between the two frontiers. We have in the computational frontier seven topical groups covering topics such as experimental algorithm parallelization, theoretical calculations and simulation, machine learning, storage and processing, resource access, end user analysis, quantum computing, and reinterpretation and long-term preservation of data and code. And there are three conveners per topical group. Again, please visit the Computational Frontier webpage, because there's plenty of information there on how you can get in touch, how you can participate. You see that the categorization in the topical groups is a little bit mixed. Some of them are focusing on activity areas, while others are focusing on technologies. But technologies such as machine learning or quantum computing, together with the use of computing accelerators in the context of high performance computing, cut across all software and computing topics, although there is not a specific group that is assessing the use of hardware accelerators or high performance computing. So let me say a few words about the activities of each one of the groups. Experimental algorithm parallelization involves the improvement and optimization of reconstruction, calibration, and physics objects algorithms. And of course, here the challenge is going to be to engineer these algorithms for use of accelerator hardware, high performance computing systems, and also ensure portability, because we would like to use multiple hardware architectures. The theoretical calculations and simulations topical group consists of six communities or subdomains, which are coordinated by volunteer contact people. These communities are in many cases almost orthogonal. I have listed them in here: theoretical calculations, lattice QCD, physics generators, detector simulation, accelerator modeling, and cosmic calculations. And once again, the technology evolution, the effective and efficient use of computer hardware accelerators and machine learning, while that will actually help us improve computing performance, while at least keeping the same physics capabilities or precision or increasing it, is where the challenge will be. Machine learning, we know it's playing a vital role in many areas of high energy physics, and it will only grow, but it's not easy to predict in which ways. The applications in all areas of high energy physics, physics specific, in simulation, in analysis. And the challenging here has to do with interpretability and validation and figuring out systematic uncertainties of the results of the output of these algorithms. But machine learning applications can benefit enormously from the use of accelerators and high performance computing systems, in particular specialized AI hardware. Storage and data access pose a significant challenge to large-scale central workflows and end-user analysis. high latency and low latency storage, and also the access of accelerator resources and specialized AI hardware is where we will find the challenges. Analysis facilities, libraries, and data storage formats and bookkeeping are central to end-user analysis. The evolution of common tools, such as, for example, Root, is very important, as well as data accessibility and the user-friendliness and scalability of proposed tools is also essential. Quantum computing is on the speculative side, and but if it works, it will bring an unparalleled revolution. And what the topical group will focus on in the context of SNOMAS is figuring out what the impact of quantum computing is on our community, as well as technologies and resources that are needed to make progress along the path of figuring out how to utilize these quantum technologies. Reinterpretation and long-term preservation of data and the software associated with our experiments is also very important if we want to be able to reanalyze our data in the future and do reinterpretation in the light of future models. So let me now go to the timelines associated with the Computational Frontier Report. By March 15th, we should have all the white papers. By the end of May, we should have preliminary reports provided by topical groups. The different frontiers should have their preliminary reports ready by the end of June. In the case of the Computational Frontier, we are shooting for frontier summary and topical group reports that are 20 to 50 pages long. For your information, the Computational Frontier has received a total of 236 letters of intent, and 18% of these are submitted jointly to the Computational Frontier and the Energy Frontier. So in order to introduce some structure to our conversation when we go to the discussion part of the session, we put together a list of questions. So I would say these are more high level general talking points. One of them is the target thesis programs of the SNOMAS process, because you may have observed that the computational frontier targets software and computing R&D in the next 10 to 15 years, mainly. That is the timescale of high-luminosity LHC. We have to put together a solid R&D program and secure funding. And that's a main objective. But we are also brainstorming about the far future. At the same time, the energy frontier seems to focus mostly on the far future, that is the post-high luminosity LHC era. So I have identified two periods. One is the near future in the next 10 to 15 years. And this includes not only high luminosity LHC, but also there are going to be some software and computing developments necessary to support all of the studies, all of the visibility studies for future machines. And one example, for example, could be computationally expensive theoretical models for simulation. So you understand what I mean. The other period is the far future, that is after 2040, and it targets the future lepton and hadron collider. Another question could be what the Computational Frontier Report content must be. we could go with something simple. That is a summary of white papers described with a similar level of detail. But we can go a step forward and include descriptions of sovereign computing challenges posed by future physics programs and also list the proposed solutions. Or we can be really ambitious and go for a roadmap for PEP software and computing R&D, including development, training, support in the USA. And if we decide to be ambitious, then the next question should be how to transform all the input that we get from the frontiers in general, in particular the energy frontier. How do we transform that input into requirements? And in turn, how to transform these requirements into a software and computing R&D roadmap. Of course, conveners can make best guesstimates, and this could be one approach. Or another possibility, one proposal, could be to establish a small working group across frontiers. And this immediately takes us to the next question, that is how we can collaborate, how the energy frontier, the computational frontier can collaborate with each other, or how we can improve and enhance our collaboration, because we are continuously collaborating, of course. And here, in my opinion, it's important to understand that there is not an us and them, really. But it is also true that the work, the plans, the strategies of the computational frontier are typically put together by the quote-unquote usual suspects, that is computing professionals or physicists with software and computing interest and expertise. Many of us also have experience with energy frontier physics, but, and this is my opinion, there is very little cross-pollination between the physics and computing worlds. And if we share this point of view, then we could discuss how to change this so that we improve. We will go back to this slide in a few minutes because I would like to use it as the first item in our discussion part of the agenda. But let me first share with you the fact that we put together a Google document where we have invited participants to post their questions or suggestions for talking points. And what we have done is to explicitly ask the computational frontier topical group conveners to post their questions in here too, so that we can start with something. Most probably, these questions will not be answered today because there are many and very detailed. But in the document, you also find the section where we call for volunteers to establish a team to address them through this NOMAS process. And so let me show you the document if you give me a sec, so that you see how it looks like. Now you see it.
Yep.
So first, there is a sentence about the questions. Then the section for you to add your name as a volunteer. At the moment, we have only one volunteer from the University of Antarctica at Icy Point. And then we list the questions by computational frontier topical group. And you will see that theoretical calculations and simulation posted some questions and also machine learning. But of course, we have to give our colleagues a break because the preparations for this workshop coincided with many of them taking vacation. So let me stop sharing and then share again. My slides, if I find them. Okay, here. Okay, I'm back in my slides. My final words are actually a reminder that the computational frontier exercise does not start from the scratch. You know that there have been numerous domestic, foreign, international planning exercises, collaborative initiatives, reviews, and they have had a large US participation. And two examples are the roadmap for software and computing R&D that was put together by the HEP Software Foundation. This is an international collaborative initiative in order to figure out how we can work on common projects for the benefit of all the high-end physics community. And another example is the material that have been submitted as part of the European strategy for particle physics process. However, what I think is that SNOMAS offers us the opportunity to revisit the software and computing strategy and roadmaps. In the light of the US programs, our interests, our domain expertise, also in the light of the development and application of what the government these days calls critical technologies. So I believe we need to take this opportunity, and I would like to repeat that the computational frontier needs and welcomes your involvement and input. So before I take questions, let me go to slide number 8. That will hopefully be the starting point of our conversation today. So let me see whether there are questions. Any raised hands? I don't see any. Alessandro, do you see any?
No, but maybe I wanted just to, well, people think about questions and items to add.
Right.
Sabine, yesterday in the plenary session, and I see her connected today here, she was mentioning another topic which we haven't discussed much, which is archiving, long-term archiving of data or even interpreted data for further manipulation or interpretations. I don't know, Samin, you're still connected, I think. Do you want to expand on that topic so we can add it to the list?
Well, yes, I'm here. So in principle, you have this preservation subgroup, the COMP-F7. That's about the data analysis preservation and so on. Now, my point for the energy frontier and also, in fact, for the theory frontier was that preserving an analysis is very nice, but when data is actually being produced, I mean, data products from the measurements, it's very important to think about how they are being presented such that they can actually be reused afterwards. And there, we have been since a decade or more, we are pursuing this in what's nowadays the reinterpretation forum. But I think it's also a topic to be considered in SNOMAS. Specifically, it's a big question when, for example, you want to combine different measurements. Like searches for new physics are often just being pursued in a general basis. But on the long term, we want to bring all available information together to have a global picture of how all the different data, for example, from the LHC or later on from the LHC plus the high luminosity LHC and maybe another future collider, how everything together constrains new physics. Along similar lines, when people talk about EFT fits, they need to bring together measurements from different sectors. For example, the vector boson production top measurements, Higgs measurements, they all present the results in different ways. But very often, specifically when we get to the regime where systematic effects dominate over statistical uncertainties, the errors are not Gaussian anymore. So we need a scheme to publish more information than just the central value or plus an uncertainty, I mean, plus minus an uncertainty. And this comes to publishing full likelihoods. And this, there have to be conventions for doing this such that it's easy to reuse them in a global fit. And such issues, I think they are interesting for the computing frontier.
Yes, and the topic is very important. That's why the conveners have established a topical group on this subject. Have you signed up for this group, or are you in contact or collaborating?
I've signed up for the group, but I haven't heard anything from them.
Okay.
I've been contacted by Jesse Thaler from TF7, so from the Siri Frontier phenomenology subgroup. And they asked for a white paper on data preservation and reuse jointly with the computing frontier. But in the energy frontier, I think there's not much happening along those lines.
Right. Maybe you can contact Kyle and Matthias. I believe Kyle is an energy frontier physicist, isn't he?
Kyle is?
Yes, he is.
So, I mean, he could be your base point of contact, so that you can participate, or maybe establish some kind of small, you know, working group within the energy frontier to contribute to this initiative.
But I am in contact with Kyle, and we have a small group who is interested in this. But no, it would be worthwhile to have a slightly wider discussion, also with the, I mean, not only from the technical point of view, but also from the physics needs.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, is
that's
physics
why I brought
needs,
it up in right? when people were talking about EFT fits.
It is actually the physics needs that give you the requirements, right? And then you think about the technical aspect.
I have a comment on this. I don't know if Shridhara. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just wondering if I could ask a quick question. It's mostly for my own education, Sabine. So when you talk about preserving analysis so that we can do EFT fits in the future, to me, this reminds me of doing things like PDF fits right now, which we do routinely. And we include measurements from the LHC and also some from older experiments like HERA and elsewhere in a relatively consistent way. I mean, it could be better, but people do the fits. Is there something that
okay,
you expanded on, or
the analogy
are you
thinking, actually not bad, because in the PDF fits, you also have to, you're limited to a chi-squared fit at the moment, right?
Yeah.
Yes, and it's not necessarily what one wants to do. Also,
okay.
you don't know all the correlations between the different measurements.
This depends on...
You don't
have
all the information that's actually needed for a measurement such that you can include it in a PDF fit. So sometimes you simply don't use a measurement that might be relevant, but there's not enough information on it. So it's to the extent that it can't actually be included in the fit.
Okay. I have some comment on this.
That one wants to avoid on the long term.
I have a comment on this, but Shridhara, I think, was before me. I don't know if the same question.
Go ahead. Mine was a tangential.
Mine is that we have this issue already now, so we don't need to wait for the future. We have this issue now, you know, between ARTIS and CMS, for example. And so far the problem is being solved, but not as much as you like, using HapData and Rivet. I agree that correlations is very important, and it's become more important, as you mentioned, EFT fits, but also I believe in PDF fits and other interpretations of data using other models. So there's Concur and other platforms that trying to do that. So I think I would say that in my humble opinion, developing these tools to make sure they provide the information that is needed in long term is the best way forward to support these tools like Rivet and the HapData and possibly others.
Sorry for interrupting, but revert is not sufficient in this case.
Well, it depends on the information you can ultimately store in there.
Yes. So now Atlas has developed for example, PyHF to publish full likelihoods. So there's the possibility to publish the full statistical model that's underlying an analysis.
But I think if you want a fuller interpretation, you won't go beyond that. You want really to look at the data more than just the model used.
On the long term, you really need both. I mean, you need the analysis description. That's the part that's stored in Revit. You need the data counts, but you also need the statistical model that underlies the analysis.
Absolutely. Because
otherwise, you can't build the likelihood.
Absolutely. But yeah.
Ideally, you want to have all the different error sources with the functional dependence. So that's what's given when you have the full statistical model. So Atlas has a scheme nowadays within PyHF. So that's a text serialization, so basically of the HisFactory model. But it's occasionally used by the SUSE group, and it's not at all used by the standard model top Higgs measurements so far.
Apologies for jumping the line here. Right, I see the hands, but I just want to say the idea of publishing likelihoods was agreed to in 2001.
Yes.
In various conferences. So it's really not a question of technical solutions. It's really a question of the experiments actually committing to do it analysis by analysis, in the same way that now we've largely committed to providing HEP data. That's really the thing that you have to solve.
I agree. It's mostly on the side of the commitment to actually do it, but there are technical issues to be solved, because it's to have a standardized scheme, for example, so that it's clear what a certain nuisance parameter actually means. One needs not only tools that simplify a given statistical model, because you don't necessarily want to work with 100 or 1,000 nuisance parameters if it's possible to prune them or to simplify them for certain applications and such things. So there are technical challenges that exist.
So to wrap up on this topic, and then we go to Srihara, and then second in line is to Ordum. Have you guys submitted, are planning to submit a white paper where you detailed proposals and solutions for the near and far future?
Well, it will certainly be good to have a light white paper on that on the topic. But what I'd like to see is a bit of involvement also from the physics groups. Otherwise, it's very standalone.
Sounds like a good plan. Okay, we should go now to Sridhara, who has patiently waited for his talk. Although he was first.
No problem. I'm talking about a completely tangential thing to this whole thing, so it made sense for them to continue. Anyway, one of the talking points which we ought to consider, I think, is the timescales in the world in our science are so long that we don't have ability to adapt, and oftentimes that slows us down to really fast evolving computing environment, both from software point of view and hardware point of view. I think that we ought to spend a little bit more attention to designing our software and our computing in such a way that if something new comes along, whether it is the GPUs or some FPGA-based computing or some other more nice idea for analysis frameworks or whatever it is, we should be able to adapt faster than we are. I think it took a long time for us to move from one particular style like PoF plus Fortran in lab days to Root plus C++, and a little bit of Python of late, it takes a while for this engine to change, both from a hardware point of view, from software point of view, from data storage point of view. Can we plan better so that we're more nimble? That will allow us to exploit both the advances in the computing industry, and also it'll train our students and others better so that if they happen to decide to go outside of our field, they can be more productive quickly outside. So I don't know if there is a topic somewhere in this talking points where it would fit in.
I cannot agree more with you, Srit Khara, and I believe that one of the main problems that is in the way to this is resources. When you're thinking about being really ambitious and develop flexible tools, and so you need a significant amount of resources. People with the appropriate expertise, training, etc. And we are facing challenges in there. But I certainly agree that that it would be nice to make the point. Anything else? Anybody else would like to comment on Srit Khara's point?
So, sure, I'll follow up a little bit on that. You're exactly right, and I think we ought to be thinking much bigger than what the set of problems we have right in front of us, and being ready to take advantage of some new technology without it taking forever is almost impossible, in the sense that you don't want to design today's software for an unknown innovation that's going to come along, because you will end up spending more time, designing out the software now for all possible innovations than you will making the software work for the particular problem that you have in front of you. Instead, I think the way we ought to be doing this is thinking about interchange and formats, because that way it's very easy to bridge. Many people who have tried to dabble between, say, the current Root ecosystem and the Python ecosystem know that moving data between the two was extremely difficult until the Root file format was well enough understood that other tools could implement it. And as soon as that happened, all of a sudden you could use Root for what it was good at, and you could use the Python ecosystem for what it was good at. And that's because the interchange was well understood. And I would encourage, as people start looking forward, this in fact has a correlation with Sabina's comment. HEP data is an interchange format. It's not about the tools, it's about the information and the format of the information. So anybody, any tool, as long as it's written to that format, can now participate, even if it's some brand new, quantum fitting global fitter or something like that. As long as it can pull the data from, say, the HEP data format, it can now participate in this ecosystem. So I think one of the key things that we need to do is, when we think about how we put together the software and the computing in the future, is we need to think less about the tools. They're definitely important, don't get me wrong, but we need to give much more weight than we have in the past to how we write the information out, how we pass information between pieces of software, the APIs, the file formats, things like that.
Gordon, I think that what you pointed out about this interchange formats is important. I think that that can happen in a very modular way in various places. For instance, if you want to do the tracking on GPUs or something like that, we right now have to put in, somehow engineer in whatever CUDA dependencies into our gigantic reconstruction program, and it just takes forever for anything to get done. Could we actually design things modularly so that very small parts can be modernized, if you like, whatever that modern stuff is in future, as long as we have the input-output things defined in a good way or in easily interchangeable format fashion and so on and so forth. I think that we ought to put in some of this up front in whatever that we're designing going into the future. Probably the free software guys are already doing many of these things, but somehow it needs to be called explicitly, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you use the tracking, and there's certainly a project called ACTS, which right now is a tracking project, which is designed to work on multiple detectors, not just a single detector. And the idea is that the APIs are the same, although the underlying geometry, material, et cetera, of course, is very different.
Exactly. That came to my mind when Simone was talking about that in the context of Muon Collider meetings that I attend. So yeah, ACTS is a good example of that. Yeah.
Right. And I think the important thing is this idea of the way we look at things can be applied to across many of the problems that we have here. I mean, we've mentioned global fitting or fitting. We've mentioned a little bit of analysis. You mentioned tracking. But the more places we can apply this view, the easier it will be in the future for people to have try new ideas and quickly plug it into our particle physics ecosystem.
I think that the example given by Gordon is a very good one, analysis tools. And there is a lot of activity in that area. One area that I find more difficult to handle is when you think of reengineering, optimizing for GPUs, for example, that is what the current computer facilities are made of, is different than optimizing or engineering for a different hardware. And that makes really things difficult because you run out of time. And so you have to decide on the technology where you would like to write your software and optimize for that software. And then by the time your experiment starts, then you have facilities that are based on different hardware. And this goes beyond the question of portability because it has to do with the structure of the code. So it's an important topic, in some areas I believe we can do better than others. Is there anything else about this topic, or should we go to Manuel?
So I haven't actually said most of the things that I raised my hand for. I was just trying to respond to Sarah's, but just to respond to what you just said, Daniel, keep in mind there's a difference between data portability and code portability. Those are two very different things. And perhaps the most important from the point of view of being able to try something new or a new technology is data portability, not code portability. The algorithm that you run on a GPU is not necessarily going to be the same one that you run on the CPU, although they will give you in the end basically equivalent physics results. One is code portability, the other is data portability. So keep those separate. They both have roles to play in our field, but I think it's important to keep those two things separate when you're thinking about how to address some of this stuff long term.
And you have more questions or comments, Gordon?
Okay, yeah. So look, this is Snowmass. So I can be a little bit more provocative than I am in other settings. So first, let me ask this just generically. Does anyone think that the future colliders, all the data won't be open? Think about what that means for whether or not that's correct, and what that would mean for the facility, for the physicists, for how you deal with the data as a member of the experiment. Are even the sociological constructs we have in a particular experiment relevant in an era where from the get-go, the data will be made open. I mean, CERN has made an, at least my Zach will be able to speak to this with much more authority than I, but my understanding is that the agreement that CERN has made with the experiments is that all data will eventually be open, something like five to 10 year gaps between when the data is taken and when it's not. Think about what that means in the context of like Peter's talk and the size of the data. And you know, imagine a theory group coming along and wanting to do a measurement the experiment didn't want to do, like some, you know, careful QCD study that nobody in the experiment could really do for whatever reason. Think about what that means from the point of view of computing.
Before we open the floor for that topic, I would like to ask Manuel what the topic of his comment or question is. Maybe it referred to the previous topic of conversation before we switch gears.
No, yeah, I mean, it's completely separate. I just wanted to ask you about your comment on cross-pollinization.
Okay, so we can first tackle Gordon's comment and then we can go to cross-pollinization, which I think it's very important for us to move forward as collaborators.
So I had a couple of just comments to throw out. And just listening to this conversation and listening to these talks, I was getting a little worried that we were too constrained by what our current, you know, the current problems were. I had the HEP data comment. The other comment is most of us who do analysis in an experiment can do actually quite a bit on a laptop. What's going to happen to that when we have exabytes worth of raw data? Will we still be able to do things on laptops? How is that going to change how we relate to the data? What we can do, you know, with a typing a command line on our laptop? How is that actually going to work? How, as you know, people who are working on the energy frontier, working with this amount of data, and we need to get a distribution, how on earth is that going to work in the future? The HLLHC will have to address some of this, but looking further forward, like if it's the Hadron collider that Peter is talking about, I mean, holy cow! How the hell is that going to work? So these were sort of, along with the other comments I already made, two things that I think, you know, that we all ought to be thinking about or thinking in terms of, and how is it, what are the big pieces that are missing? I mean, one thing you can just say is we don't have enough hardware yet. Okay, that's true. But surely it's going to be more than hardware we're going to have to bring to bear in order to solve some of this. At the HLLHC, of course, and also further beyond. I think I prompted Zach to, he may have some direct comment to that. So maybe we ought to ask him if he's got something he directly wants to comment on there.
Just because I like being contrarian. So I'll do that for you, Gordon. I don't awesome. Think future collider data will be open initially. I do agree with you. Eventually, it will be open in some form. But like the LHC agreement is to open a very digested format that just has, you know, jets, four vectors, electron four vectors, those sorts of things. That will be highly limiting to what sort of additional analyses can be done. For example, the format that Atlas has agreed to open for the remainder of the HLLHC and, you know, the remainder of the run, it will not be possible to do any long-lived particle searches of any kind in that data. Simply impossible with the open data. Frankly, I sort of expect that kind of thing to continue, that the experiments will open very limited formats. And for anything more complicated, they'll expect people to directly join the experiments and speak with experts and contribute to the experiments, because otherwise I think the experiments simply won't have the person power to do what they want to do. To your other point about what can you do on a laptop, Atlas's data set size now is 200 petabytes. You don't have that on your laptop. So I think when we talk about 20 to 30 years from now, having a data set that's one or two orders of magnitude larger, it would not surprise me if 20 or 30 years from now, my laptop hard drive is one or two orders of magnitude larger, and that it's just a non-issue. It also wouldn't surprise me if network connectivity is such with my laptop in 20 or 30 years that I don't care how big my laptop hard drive is. And I'm back to the old workstation model where everyone is constantly connected to servers. You know, people have already tried this for video games and for movies. It works extremely well. Why does anyone buy a DVD anymore? You know, why aren't we thinking about just existing on that model at a certain point?
I totally agree. Why aren't we thinking of existing on that model? And it's the point here, right, is to push. I know Sabina said, and I think response to what you said, Zach, that the CMS open data approach is different. Maybe Sabina, could you just quickly say what you mean?
Yes, well, CMS is publishing already much more in terms of open data, and they do different levels of reconstruction. So they have really raw data, and they have reconstructed jets and leptons and so on, but they do publish their data also in the form that one can actually do a new analysis with it.
So what you're saying, Sabina, is that you could do a long-lived particle analysis.
I'm not sure about a long-lived particle analysis.
So we need to wrap up because
long-lived particles, they are very, very difficult objects.
We have 10 minutes to go.
Certainly for jet measurements, there have already been new studies from the CUI side. I mean, this was Chess et al.
Now, let me tell you that in addition to the necessary data, right? If the data is made available not only in limited formats but more widely available, I mean more details, you also need the expertise, right? If you don't have the expertise of the experiment, you can analyze and say nonsense. But you know, maybe
that should not limit the fact that it's actually being made public. Then somebody with the right expertise can do something new. I absolutely agree with Gordon that we should sing along these terms that this will be.
Well, of course, we should. Yeah. I would like to go to Manuel because we have only 8 minutes left.
It was just that quick question. So you mentioned that a lot of the computing work in HAP is being done by the usual suspects that really know both the physics and the computing. But at the same time, you mentioned how, in your opinion, there's too little cross-pollinization between the physics and the computing worlds. And so what do you exactly mean, and how do you imagine a larger cross-pollinization happening?
Well, what I meant is something different. What I'm saying is that, you know, if you take a look at who is attending these meetings, it's mostly the usual suspects. I mean, the same people who wrote the documents in the context of the international community. So I am wondering whether it would be actually worth to put significant effort in expanding this community, this relatively small community of physicists and computing professionals with interest in computing. I wouldn't say that most of them actually have experience doing actually physics analysis. And that's the problem that I see, a separation between these two worlds. We have people who are very oriented towards the end of the chain, and then people who are very interested in the technical aspects on how to resolve challenges and software and computing challenges. That's why I'm saying, and of course, this is an opinion. Somebody else can have a different perception. I'm wondering whether we can do better in getting young people with physics analysis interested in participating in these brainstorming activities about how we plan for computing in the near and far future. I'm not sure if I.
I see. No. I think I now fully understand you. I have to say, I think things are slowly changing. I think that there's been an effort by a lot of the usual suspects, I think, and more, to really emphasize how important computing is, how big of a challenge it is coming, how we need to give it more prestige, how it's really now becoming as important as building a better tracker to really be able to do physics in the next few years. And like, for instance, I have to say, I mean, just a few years ago, it was not even in my radar. And now I'm like studying, like really getting more into this while totally keeping doing only analysis. And I suspect there was not maybe even, other people like this.
There was not even separate funding a few years ago, which made it difficult for a university professor to say, hey, I'm doing software and computing, and here is the money that I contribute to the physics department, right? So as you say, it's improving. Yeah, of course, yeah. But we've seen that. But we still have to, I mean, in the time scale of the near and far future as defined here, what else can we do to improve? We can start by see how we can integrate more people through this NOMOS process, I thought.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for bringing it up. I think that was very helpful. Great, thank
you. Okay, Krzysztof Genzer, we have 5 minutes left, so we have to move on.
Hi, so I have a slightly different question towards the members of the Energy Frontier community, namely, we are getting feedback from other frontiers, and hereby we mean people related with the involved with the Monte Carlo toolkits or event generators, that some capabilities are not currently available and some processes which need to be simulated are missing. Can anybody comment on that regarding the energy frontier and especially regarding the very far future experiments? Thanks.
Maybe Alessandro, is he still there?
Yeah, to be honest, I didn't quite get the question. I mean, can you be more specific in what you mean?
Well, I mean, do you see anything missing in the current event generators or detector simulation toolkits, which would prevent people from doing the physics or simulating the physics, which is going to be done, again, especially with those very far future colliders or accelerators?
You mean physics models in the generators or physics models in the detector simulation tools?
Right? Well, it can be both. It's a very broad question.
Yeah, so I think one of the problems, Chris, is there definitely are processes that we cannot currently simulate very accurately and where we are in some sense limited by that. Or processes in the future that we will absolutely have to be able to simulate that we cannot currently, and we're just not there yet. As a silly example, once you go to a very high energy FCC HH, you need to start worrying about things like top contributions to the proton PDF, which are definitely not something that are on anybody's radar today, but eventually they could be at very high energies. So I think we're gonna get there, but I think if anybody tells you we don't have a path to process X or Y, then they're exaggerating a little bit too much. Since I unmuted, there's one other point I wanted to make to come back to Steve Gottlieb's point about funding, which is I think stability is one of the key things that we're missing here. That relates to a lot of the things we've talked about. Open data, the LEP data are in principle, some of them at least are in principle open. If you try to simply find them on the web, you get a mess of broken links and, you know, disappearing emails and all kinds of issues. We need to make sure that if we're going to open the LHC data, it's stored somewhere that's permanent. Similarly, for things like the computing requirements that Peter described, if we're going to do those with some of the HPC systems that are being designed in the US, an experiment cannot be completely uncertain of its computing budget from year to year. We need multi-year guarantees on those sorts of systems. And there are some pieces of software like generators, like JANT4 that are so critical to the funding program that we really need to have long-term commitments to them from labs and universities with permanent positions, as I think a bunch of people, including Savannah most recently, have mentioned in the chat. We need to make sure that there's a viable path for people in terms of career. And once people see that, they'll show up, because that's one of the things that's scaring people away, for sure, is the feeling that this is a dead end for their career.
You need the funding for that, though. I mean, I don't think there could be institutional commitment if there is no funding for that. At least that's the way I see things work.
That's the whole point. Yep, we absolutely, right. It's a funding issue. And as Steve pointed out, this is really a funding question for P5 to try and address, that they need to improve the stability of funding for certain things.
If I may add something else, often I see that in experiments, future experiments or upgrades, detectors come first, right? People think about data analysis and then detectors and infrastructure, but sometimes the computational aspects are left to later times. And so developer architecture for computing is left a second step rather than initial step. I think more coordination very early on is necessary for future collider, especially as you mentioned, the HH 100TV. I think it will be critical. The difficult part is that we don't know what will be the computational scenario landscape in 10 years from now, let alone 30, 50 years from now. So this is, it becomes more futuristic. But somehow I think when we start developing the infrastructure for any accelerator, the computational part has to be integral to the discussion and not left to the second step.
Okay, it's 2:30 Eastern time, 1:30 Central, 11:30 California. So we need to wrap up, I believe. So how do we move forward? We put together this list of talking points. We haven't gone through mostly. There are some decisions to be made. So the computational frontier has already decided to focus mostly on the near term for a variety of reasons. But some of us believe that we should also have a brainstorming, and we have to have some exercises and some words about the far future. And what we discussed today was, you know, had a lot to do with the far future, by the way. But, you know, we need to converge on that, I would say, in what relates to the energy frontier, say, on the topic. But most importantly, I would like to know your opinion on how we move forward. How do we enhance this collaboration between energy frontier and computing frontier? Because, you know, we could just go back to our own, right? I mean, just to, as an example, Peter Onisi gave the presentation for the energy frontier, but he's one of the topical group conveners in the computing frontier. Gordon and Zach, who have participated a lot in this conversation, are really involved in computational frontier work in a very significant way. So are most of the people who talk today. So what should we do towards the future? How should we face the writing of the report with the input that we have that are going to be the white papers? And you can take a look at the LOIs and pretty much figure out what they are going to be about.
So maybe I come up, throw an idea. I think we could do with maybe the two of us, Danielle can write the minutes of the discussion we had today. And in the Google Doc that you created, we make it available to everybody. We link it to this webpage, and maybe we send an email to the whole Energy Frontier mailing list and put in Slack too, and ask people to enter talking points, ideas of collaboration or needs that need to be thought about by both frontiers. And and we move from there. So seeing the ideas and what people come up with. And as you hinted, Daniel, I think we're also looking for volunteers, so people who have ideas and that could help us addressing questions that are common between energy frontier and computational frontier. So any person who volunteers to help out on this will be useful, and maybe those names can be added to the Google Doc. Any thought about that? Feedback?
Sounds good to me. What about other ideas?
Danielle, this is the beginning of a conversation. We just have to keep it up.
True.
Keep people aware of what we're doing, and you're the liaison to the energy frontier. So you keep abreast of what they're doing, and hopefully people will participate.
Yeah, I think these talking points that Danielle listed here and those are listed in the Google Doc are a starting point. And maybe we can ping people to enter ideas and thoughts, questions. And I think we could put a summary of also what we discussed today, which there were many useful topics of discussion. Some are open-ended and some can be formulated in specific questions that we have to tackle towards the final reports, which have to be written in the summer next year.
All right. Should we close the meeting, Alessandro?
Yeah, I think it's a good point to close the meeting. And I remind people we have slightly less than half an hour break, so 24 minutes roughly now. And then we'll continue with unstructured discussion on Munich Collider and new ideas. So we'll continue discussion on future colliders and I'm not sure computational issues will be tackled first, but I think definitely is interesting for everybody to attend. And hopefully it will be interesting to the majority of people are connected now.
Okay, fantastic. So thank you everyone for attending this session. I think it was very useful and we have a plan. So continue to enjoy the workshop and see you guys around.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks.